Today we have Stephen Snoblin giving his sixth class on the theme Biblical Perspectives on the Environment. And this class is entitled The Environmental Crisis, Is Christianity to Blame?
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm going to be bringing together some of the themes that we've been looking at throughout this weekend, but we're also going to spend a bit more time dealing with this critique that is directed against the Bible and Christianity in general from some people who argue that the Bible is one of the reasons why we are in an environmental crisis. So what I want to do is I want to answer this question in two ways, essentially. I'm going to argue that the critique is not wholly wrong, that Christianity does not have a perfect record on the environment, but also it doesn't have a perfect record with respect to attitudes about this world, this material, physical world in which we live. But I'm also going to argue that the biblical text itself is not hostile to the environment, but quite the reverse. Now, I want to begin by just outlining some things that are probably familiar to everyone, and that is that there are some serious problems with the environment today. And although scientists and others debate the degree to which these are anthropogenic, that is to say from human, or whether they're part of climatic cycles, the point is that there are some serious issues, and many scientists, climate scientists, have even gone so far as to say we have passed the point of no return. So Lovelock, who is famous for his Gaia hypothesis, has said that. He said that we're already too far gone. We can't save the environment. There are many groups who are making this kind of claim. What you're looking at right here is a little bit of Canadian content that I'm introducing to our presentation tonight. This is Northern Alberta, tar sands project. And you can see in the background the beautiful forest and hills. But in the foreground, of course, you see the earth being scarred by these massive pieces of equipment digging up this shale, which is then rendered into petroleum products at a very high cost. It's a very labor-intensive and actually, ironically, uses up a lot of fuel to produce. So this is the famous or infamous tar sands project, and here you see what is left over and some of the pollution that remains. Now, this is a picture from just last month in China showing the smog that many cities in China are facing, and so the traffic policeman has a mask on because of that pollution. That, of course, is not natural. What you're looking at right here is what is called mountaintop removal mining. And so in the hills of Kentucky and West Virginia, they have a lot of coal. And the easiest way to get at that coal is literally to blast the top of the mountains off. And so this is what you end up with. And notice, by the way, that there are some houses here where people live, not too far from that scarred hillside. And here's another scene. First one is from Kentucky, and this one is from West Virginia. So that's what's left. It's not a pretty sight. It's a very devastating way of extracting the coal, which is then burned and leads to pollution and raises the level of carbon in our atmosphere. Here's a picture, or three pictures, showing deforestation in the lower 48 states. From 1620 to 1920, and if you were to look at a fourth picture showing today, there would be even less green. So this is virgin timber, which has been cut down. The whole eastern seaboard was forested originally. Another problem that we have is plastic. It's everywhere, and we're throwing it out. It's ending up in the ocean, and you can see here a shoreline with accumulated plastic debris. And here is a hapless fisherman trying to fish in this mess. Now, this plastic breaks down and ultimately turns into microspheres. And if you go to pretty much any beach, any sandy beach in the earth, and scoop up some sand, you'll find that a certain percentage of that sand consists of small plastic and polymer microspheres. And this is going to be in the environment for millions of years. It doesn't tend to biodegrade. And this is all, you know, anthropogenic. It's obviously caused by human beings. Here's a very sad aspect of that. You see an albatross here died in Australia, and you can see all the plastics that this albatross has consumed. So although we can debate about climate cycles, some of them are natural, certainly there is strong evidence that humanity has done a lot of damage to the Earth. And some of this damage is going to be mighty hard to rectify. Now, as mentioned that we're currently living in Southern California. Now, this is a major freeway interchange, the 110 and the 105, famous or infamous, depending on one's perspective. So this is the sort of thing that we've done to the landscape, removing the green spaces and putting in these concrete jungles. Here's another one from Southern California. I gave a similar talk a number of weeks ago in Southern California. I had to sort of apologize that these slides were there, and it wasn't my intention to pick on Southern California, because, of course, these freeway interchanges exist all over the world, in Asia, they exist in Europe, et cetera. Another thing that humankind has done since the 1940s is introduced nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And these can have a devastating impact on the environment. And we know this because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We also know this because of the recent tsunami in Japan and the difficulty in getting rid of the nuclear contamination. And the half-life is very long, and a lot of this nuclear contamination is going to be around for a long time to come. Chernobyl in the 1980s is another infamous case. So we could go on. There are lots of problems with the environment, and we can certainly identify many that are caused by humans. Now, what are scientists saying? Well, I've already alluded to one scientist, Lovelock, who is arguing that we've gone past the point of no return. The environment is going to do us in. And he has a book called The Revenge of Gaia, in which he's arguing that the Earth is almost like it's a person, is kicking back, it's fighting back, it's been damaged, and humanity is going to suffer. So this is a very pessimistic view, but it's not an uncommon view about the environment. Now, Sir Martin Rees, otherwise known as Lord Rees, who's the Astronomer Royal in Britain, was for a time Master of Trinity College in Cambridge, wrote a book in 2003, called Our Final Hour, A Scientist's Warning How Terror, Error, and Environmental Disaster Threaten Humankind's Future in This Century on Earth and Beyond. Some of you may recognize in the short title of the book, Our Final Hour, the phrase from Churchill, Our Finest Hour, from World War II. Well, that was a positive phrase. In this case, it is a negative one. And so what is Rees arguing? Well, he goes through a litany of problems that the Earth is facing, and one of the big ones is the environment. And he says, we have a 50-50 chance of surviving the 21st century as a species. 50-50. Now, Rees is not, as far as I'm aware, religious, although he does attend Anglican chapel. So he doesn't have, he's not making a religious argument. This is not a kind of a fire and brimstone kind of argument. This is just a sober assessment of a scientist who has looked at the facts. It's a very pessimistic assessment. So, again, I could go on, but the point is that scientists and others who are observing the environment and related issues all agree that there are huge problems. Lots of things that I haven't mentioned, the huge dead zones in some of the oceans, the overfishing, depleted fish stocks, rising sea levels, and the effect that's going to have on coastal communities, low-lying countries, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, environmental crisis. I think we can all agree that there is an environmental crisis, and I think we all can agree that, at least to a certain extent, humanity is the cause of the environmental crisis. Of course, it's more complicated than that because in nature there are feedback mechanisms and there are these natural cycles as well. But humanity is clearly a part of the problem. Now, with respect to our major theme, this idea that Christianity has a particular attitude about the world that leads to a negative attitude about the environment actually goes back some years. So Ludwig Feuerbach, who is a German scholar and atheist from the 19th century, said this: "Nature, the world, has no value, no interest for Christians. The Christian thinks only of himself and the salvation of his soul." Now, I'm going to suggest that this assessment is not necessarily wholly wrong. If one thinks in general terms about the Christian tradition, and I'll explain what I mean by that as we move on in our presentation. Nevertheless, it's also, to a certain extent, a caricature, certainly with respect to what the biblical tradition is actually saying about the natural world, which in biblical parlance is, of course, creation. Now, if you will indulge me, I'm going to take you back to the 1970s. Some of you may remember the famous crying Indian commercial. So if the technology works, I'll play you this commercial.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
So that was part of the Keep America Beautiful campaign, which is still ongoing, by the way. Now, just a bit of autobiography. I well remember seeing this commercial on television when I grew up on the Sanish Peninsula. And I was deeply offended when I saw this. I should ask my brothers whether they had the same experience. That someone would actually throw trash out of a window in a freeway to land at this hapless Indian's feet. And then that tear that you see on his cheek. It's a very moving and very well put together commercial, and it actually won some awards. It's one of the most famous commercials ever produced. But there's some interesting issues behind it that need to be unpacked. First of all, was that guy actually an Indian or a Native American? Stephen, you're shaking your head. And you're right, he wasn't. He was the son of Sicilian immigrants. He was an actor who played natives in the movies, going right back to the silent era. And he was exposed near the end of his life as a kind of a fraud. But actually, a lot of Native Americans thought that he'd done a lot of good for the Native American cause. He actually used to dress like a Native, and him and his wife adopted two true-blood Native American sons. But the point I want to make about this very clever and well-put-together and very moving commercial is that it's suggesting that there are certain cultures that have lived in harmony with the environment and there are other cultures that have not. So by placing the hero as a Native American, the point is that Native Americans have lived close to the environment. They're not the reason why there is a lot of pollution and environmental degradation, but it's actually the Europeans. Now, there's actually a lot of truth in this. There's no doubt about that. But clearly, there's a kind of agenda here, and it fits into this overall critique that we've been speaking about throughout this presentation, that Western culture in particular has done a lot to ruin the environment. And again, actually, there's a lot of truth in that. So let's just summarize the ecological complaint against Christianity. First, monotheism in general and Christianity in particular is the primary, if not sole cause, of the despoilation of the earth. Second, the emphasis within the Christian tradition on dualisms of soul and body, spirit and matter, denigrates the earth and sanctions its misuse and exploitation. This is something we're going to say something about a little bit later on. A third argument, often cited by critics, derives from the perceived inadequacies in Christian eschatology. For those of you who are not familiar with the word eschatology, it just refers to teachings about the end times and the future of the earth. So what is a particular Christian's eschatology? Do they believe, for example, that the earth is going to be destroyed after the return of Christ? Actually, that's a very common belief, and it's something we talked about earlier in this weekend. Or do Christians, or some Christians, hold that the earth is going to be preserved, right? This is a debating point. Now, that actually can have a big effect on how one views the environment. If you think that the earth is going to be destroyed, then maybe you might not care too much about preserving it. Fourthly and finally, medieval historian Lynn White Jr., in his famous and oft-reprinted 1967 essay, The Historical Roots of Our Ecologic Crisis, claims that because of its role in the rise of modern science and technology, Christianity bears a huge burden of guilt for the present situation. And this from Stephen Bowman Prediger, an evangelical environmentalist. Now, I want to just present a kind of an aside here before we move on. So we've seen that there are these criticisms about the Bible and Christianity, that there's a negative attitude about the environment, that maybe this otherworldly perspective that many Christians have, that we're going to hop off the earth, off this plane of existence, into heaven, into a pure realm of spiritual existence. And that, and we're going to come to this, this notion of dominion, which we read about in Genesis chapter 1, is something that people took up, understood it to be domination, and as a license to exploit and degrade the earth and life upon it. So what I want to do to just kind of shake this up a little bit is to point out that the environmental movement, although many in the environmental movement are anti-religious and hostile to religion, have actually picked up some religious language from the Bible and used it in a positive way. So back in 2007, some volunteers from Greenpeace actually built a small replica of Noah's Ark and put it partway up the hillside on Mount Ararat. And there you can see it's almost complete, as a way of drawing attention to global warming and rising sea levels. Well, these aren't necessarily religious people, but they can see the power of this story of Noah's Ark, which, of course, was presented in a movie from earlier this year. This is the Rainbow Warrior, a Greenpeace ship, and you can see on it the rainbow and the dove, which, again, come from the story of Noah and the flood. Similarly, Picasso produced several of these paintings showing the dove with an olive leaf in its mouth, and this has become an internationally recognized symbol of peace, once again coming from the account of Noah and the flood. Here's another example that also appeals to Noah, a very clever cover from New Scientist from about a decade ago, the 21st Century Ark. So this is an effort to preserve information and samples of the biota on the earth in case, for example, some species go extinct. I just love the way they've taken the zebra and put the barcode behind it. And there's another picture from the same issue. But appealing to Noah's Ark, the Frozen Ark project is a project to freeze various heritage seeds up in Norway in case, again, some of them go extinct. So it's sort of like having a backup for these heritage seeds. But the metaphor that's being used here is the ark, because Noah, of course, in the flood, well, along with his family, takes animals and puts them on the ark to preserve them alive. And this includes, importantly, unclean animals, which don't have an immediate use to the people for food or for beasts of burden, so that there's a sense here that the unclean animals have intrinsic value. So Lynn White Jr., and you have a handout which outlines some critiques of Lynn White Jr.'s famous paper, published this paper in the journal Science, which is a leading, still is to this day, a leading science journal. Now, Lynn White Jr. was not a scientist. He was actually a medieval historian. That is to say, he was a historian of the Middle Ages, not that he was a historian in the Middle Ages. And his paper is actually rather complicated, because although he very powerfully critiques Christianity's interpretation of Genesis chapter 1 and this idea that dominion in Genesis chapter 1 is domination, Lynn White Jr. was actually a Christian. He was a Catholic. And he actually argued that there is the opportunity for reform within Christianity. So I just want to put that out there, that his paper does have some nuance, but there's some serious misinterpretation of the Genesis account of creation. And this has led to a lot of responses. And these responses are ongoing. People are still responding to this paper. So got a lot of coverage. So this is one scholar's articulation of Lynn White's model. So what he's saying that Lynn White is arguing is that you have the Judeo-Christian tradition, which emerges, and it's obviously the foundation of the Western tradition. And out of the Judeo-Christian tradition in the West, in the period that we call the Scientific Revolution, this is something that actually that I teach as part of my job as a historian of science, you see the emergence of science and technology. Science and technology emerge in Christian Europe. It's just a matter of the record. Yes, we see some amazing accomplishments in China. We see some amazing accomplishments in ancient Greece and Rome. But they never produced something like science with the scientific method, empirical approach, etc. So a lot of scholars argue that there's something about Christianity, the Judeo-Christian tradition, that helped create science. Now, I can tell you that it's actually a lot more complicated than that. And I read an article recently by a Jewish scholar whose name is actually Noah, Noah Ephron. And he critiqued this argument that Christianity gave birth to science. And a lot of Christian historians of science and others have wanted to make this argument, because science has so much cachet today, and if you can say that Christianity gave birth to science, well, you're saying something, right? What Noah Ephron essentially says is two things. Number one, the linkage is not necessarily as tight as many like to claim. There were other influences that led to the rise of modern science. But secondly, he also says, and this is a very clever point, be careful what you wish for. Because after all, not everything that science and technology has produced is something we would call good, even in a moral sense. And so I showed you that picture of the atomic explosion, right? And a few months ago, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, was being interviewed by Jon Stewart on television. And the interview quickly turned to the question of who is more likely to lead to the end of civilization, scientists or religious people? And it's a very clever argument. And Jon Stewart managed to get Richard Dawkins, this leading atheist. Actually, Dawkins claims that he's not an atheist. He's an agnostic, but he leans towards atheism. But he's certainly known as an atheist. He got Dawkins to admit, actually, you know, If we do ourselves in, it's going to be science and technology, not religion, that does it. Although he kind of also wanted to argue that maybe, you know, some religious fanatic might get a hold of, you know, some powerful science and do it. But science has the power to destroy this earth, right? So this argument that science has come out of Christianity is something that maybe one might want to pause and consider a little bit. Again, the critique of Noah Ephron, be careful what you wish for. And this is not an attempt to denigrate science. I love science. This is why I got into the history of science. But it's not above critique. And so the third stage is environmental degradation. Now, what Moncrief argued is actually it's much more complicated. You have Judeo-Christian tradition, which leads to capitalism with the attendant development of science and technology and democratization. So you have these political structures that come into place. And then the third phase is urbanization, increased wealth, increased population, and increased resource ownership. And involved in this is accumulative materialism, etc. And this leads to environmental degradation. So there are a lot of other factors that come in along the way, which complicate what Moncrief is saying is the overly simplistic model of Lynn White Jr. Okay, let's go to the text. We've looked at it already in our reading. Genesis chapter 1, starting at verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man. This is the word Adam. This is the standard word for human in the Bible. It's cognate with Adama, which is the word for ground. This is what we are. We're ground. We're earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And I should just add that, so we have this granting of dominion, which is the big debating point. But at the same time, and bestowing of the image of God, or what theologians refer to as the imago Dei, the image of God on humans. But the very name human in Hebrew is a very humble one, right? It's soil. So our name is mud, basically. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. That's what the King James says. It just means fill the earth. And subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So we have the second reference to dominion. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you all it shall be for meat. This is the quaint early modern way of just referring to food, because actually this is not meat in the modern sense. It appears to be a vegetarian diet. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. That's the first use of the word green, by the way, in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1. Okay, so the big contentious point is dominion. What is dominion? We use it in many different ways, the Dominion of Canada, for example. Well, Lynn White Jr. is saying that it was interpreted as domination. Now, whether Lynn White Jr. believed that the text is actually saying that is a little difficult to determine from his text. But people picked up this argument that, yes, this is what Genesis is saying, is that humans can dominate the earth. They are the lords of creation. So, this is the question. Is dominion domination in this text, or is it benign stewardship? Well, if we look at the text in context, we see more nuance. So, firstly, in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 8, we see this very interesting description of God planting a garden. You don't see this kind of language in Genesis chapter 1. You have more of a cosmic perspective in Genesis chapter 1. But in Genesis 2, we move in, we zero in on a very local, localized context. And we see God interacting in a much more intimate way with the environment. So we see him forming the first human with his hands and breathing into his nostrils the breath of life. That's the verse immediately before this one, these two. chapter 2 and verse 7. And here we see a description of God planting a garden in Eden. Now, probably what is meant here is that angels are participating in it, not the transcendent God of the universe. But nevertheless, you have this kind of intimate language. God here is clearly at one level meant to be a model for humans to emulate. So what is God doing? Not cutting down trees. He's planting trees. He's creating a garden, or what may more appropriately be called an orchard. In the Greek translation of the Genesis account of creation, the term garden is translated with the word paradisos, which is where we get the word paradise from. And in the Persian language, this referred to an enclosed orchard. So that's roughly what we have. We have a description of trees. And notice that it says that they are pleasing to the sight as well as good for food. So they have this aesthetic quality. Okay, so we begin to see in this presentation of God this idea of this sort of benign management. And this is now suggesting that what we're talking about here with dominion is a benign stewardship. But the point really comes home when we move on to Genesis chapter 2. So I'm going to show you this in four different translations. And the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. That's from the 1611 King James. And then in the ESV, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. God's Word translation, then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to farm the land and to take care of it. Now, that language of farming may seem a little bit surprising, but when you look at Genesis chapter 2, it's clear that the garden in Eden is a kind of a domestic space. It's a landscape that is managed by the human. So it's not untouched wilderness. And then finally, in the International Standard Version, the Lord God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden in order to have him work it and guard it. So what does the Hebrew point to here? Well, in Genesis 2:15, the Adam, the human, is placed in the garden to till it. So the word abad is the word behind till there in the Hebrew, and to keep it, shamar. And what we're seeing here is the language of serving and preserving the garden. The Hebrew word abad means to work or to serve or to till. And in this context, it refers to working the ground in the sense of cultivation and preparing for planting. While the Hebrew shamar means to guard, as in setting a hedge roundabout with the sense of protecting and preserving. This theme of the preservation of the garden is reinforced by the word used for garden in the account, which is gan, which means a fenced garden, which derives from a verb, ganan, which means to hedge about or protect. So from this language, believers can conclude that their duty is to serve and preserve the garden that is this world. And this is supported by a Christian botanist. And this is what he says. The Genesis text leaves us in no doubt that people were created to be caretakers and not destroyers of the earth. Amidst the terrifying environmental destruction, pollution, and loss of species that is happening today, it is salutary to look at the remit given by God to the first people. Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to till it and to keep it. The Hebrew word abad, translated till, also means to serve, and shamar, translated keep, means to watch or preserve. The instruction to the first people was to serve and preserve the land. Humankind was given dominion or lordship over the rest of creation to look after it and not to destroy it and all the other creatures which God also created. It follows that care for creation is a Christian responsibility today, since those who know the Creator should really be the first to give a lead in the protection of his creation. Professor Sir Gillian Prance, fellow of the Royal Society, former director of the Kew Royal Botanical Gardens in London. By the way, just as an aside, that's a great name, Professor Sir Gillian Prance, FRS, right? And he's very much an Englishman and was also involved in the founding of the Eden Project in Cornwall, which I'll mention just in a few minutes. All right. Now, there were some responses to the Lynn White paper, and they're very important because they actually set the agenda for some of the later responses. So Emiliani and Niskin's response is as follows. White's stringent demonstration that today's ecological catastrophe results directly from the Judeo-Christian tradition can be expanded to include other catastrophes of similar or greater magnitude which occurred earlier in time. Martin, Nature, 1966, has argued at some length the early overkills which destroyed 40% of the mammalian fauna in Africa and 70% in North America. And this includes the so-called megafauna, the Irish elk and the giant beavers that used to inhabit North America. These overkills, which took place respectively 50,000 and 12,000 years ago, clearly demonstrate that the Judeo-Christian tradition is considerably older than generally assumed. Now, this is meant in part to be a little bit of a joke, because of course he doesn't mean that literally. But what he does mean is, wait a second, we see other examples of, other than in the European setting, of environmental degradation, including examples that happened long before Christianity emerged. So what Emiliani and Niskin are suggesting is that the problem is more basic than a particular religion, and that problem, of course, is human nature, which we all share. So I'll give you some examples of some other cases of environmental degradation other than in our own age. So in ancient Mesopotamia, we see canal siltation and topsoil salination due to improper irrigation techniques in the Tigris and the Euphrates river systems, which led to a collapse in farming in that area. The desertification in the Sahara, scientists and scholars debate about this, but there's a lot of evidence that this was largely anthropogenic. Deforestation, something we've already talked about, occurred in many areas in the ancient world. The Pleistocene extinctions, which scientists date to 14,000 to 11,000 years ago, of megafauna, I've already referred to this, in North America, probably caused by overhunting by Paleo-Indians. And there's a little note there from Science. It's the same journal that White published his paper in. Buffalo kills on the Great Plains of North America. These were hugely wasteful when buffaloes were herded over cliffs, and they literally couldn't get at the meat fast enough before it began to decompose, because buffaloes on top of buffaloes were piled up. The Anasazi Indians of the Chaco Canyon around 1100 AD, this is pre-Columbian, before European contact, deforestation leading to erosion of their fields and the demise of their crop production. Polynesians, the Polynesian ancestors of the Maoris arrived in New Zealand about 700 years ago. It's relatively recent. And with 100 years, had hunted the moas to extinction, which is really sad because it would be great to see these creatures. And this appears to have led to the extinction of a giant eagle species as well in a biological domino effect. Easter Island, many of you are probably familiar with Easter Island. By the time of European contact, the islanders were clinging to existence after denuding the island of trees and other biota, apparently in the pursuit of religious ideals. So here's a book by Shepherd Creech III called The Ecological Indian, in which he argues that this idea that Indians were always, Paleo-Indians and Native Americans more recently, were always living in perfect harmony with the environment is actually a myth, although I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes and suggest that there is also some truth to it. This is Easter Island. So you've seen these monoliths, and the people on the island seem desperate to produce these monoliths, even though it involved cutting down all the trees on the island. So there are no trees larger than small bushes to this day, but they have these very bizarre-looking monuments. Okay, so recent studies have shown the following. Number one, that Western religion, including Christianity and culture, have not been as hostile to the environment as claimed by some. Number two, non-Western religion and culture have not been as gentle on the environment as claimed by some. Now, I want to bring in another example, and this would be the former East Bloc countries. If you want to see bad examples of environmental management, go to the countries of the former East Bloc and see the kind of damage that was caused during the communist period. Of course, the communists in the former East Bloc were officially atheistic, so this had nothing to do with Western religion. In sum, every culture has an imperfect record. Human nature persists despite the ideals of the world religions. So there's something more basic, and that is human greed and lack of foresight. Here's James Nash's evaluation, this is on your handout as well, of the ecological critique of Christianity. He argues that this critique tends to reduce the explanation of the complex ecological crisis to a single cause, to exaggerate the authority of Christianity in cultures. I mean, it's an interesting kind of complement to Christianity and the Bible, that Christianity and the Bible actually had that much impact on society and the environment. Number three, to minimize the fact that non-Christian cultures also have been environmental despoilers, and this includes Native American, includes cultures that were traditionally Buddhist, Hindu, and of course, as I said, the Marxist societies as well. Number four, to overlook the number of dissenting opinions in the Christian tradition. And relatedly, number five, to underestimate the potential for ecological reform in Christianity. And so, in fact, there's a huge and growing environmental movement within the Christian tradition and within Judaism as well. Now, what are the alternatives? One of the alternatives is something called deep ecology, and I think I referred to it earlier this weekend. So this is the idea that humans are a serious problem for the environment, and what we need to do is we need to vacate large tracts of land. So one proposal is that we vacate the interiors of all the continents and just move out to the coastal regions. Well, deep ecology has been criticized from many different vantage points, and here's a summary of some of those criticisms. It is conceptually vague and overly idealistic. It is misanthropic. You know, it's against humanity. Biocentric equality isn't practical. A biological value hierarchy is necessary when making certain decisions about the environment. This is true even of radical environmentalists. Speciesism can be benign, and virtually everyone, including most environmentalists, adhere to it in some form. A benign form of anthropocentrism will be good for the environment, since the preservation and flourishing of lower organisms is essential for human survival on this planet. So if we want to live good lives, then we need to make sure that the environment is in good shape. So a pro-human approach isn't necessarily incompatible with a good environment. And so we have the example of many Christian scientists, Christians who are scientists, not Christian scientists, although there might be Christian scientists as well. And here's our friend Gillian Prance, published a book called Smart Plants. And here he is talking about his Christian faith and how his Christian faith motivates his environmentalism. R.J. Berry, a British biologist, edits a book called The Care of Creation. From a Christian perspective, Stephen Bowman Prediker, we've already mentioned him, a quotation from him, For the Beauty of the Earth, which is a quotation from a hymn. Cherishing the Earth, How to Care for God's Creation. Gardening Eden by a landscape gardener. The Bible and Ecology by Richard Bachman. And Let Creation Rejoice, Biblical Hope and Ecological Crisis. I've got a copy of that right here. And what's happening with a lot of these sources is that they're going back and looking at the biblical text and what it says about human nature and concluding that the Bible actually doesn't teach a dualistic view of the human, that we don't have a soul, but that we are entirely physical. And so therefore this critique against Christianity, that it leads to this kind of dualistic view that souls are separate from the material world, et cetera, and this can have a damaging effect on our attitudes towards the environment. Well, that critique applies to Christians who hold that view, but it doesn't apply to the Bible because that particular view is not taught in the Bible. And the other thing that a lot of these scholars are pointing to, and in this case, Jonathan Moo is a New Testament scholar and Robert White is a scientist at the University of Cambridge, they're showing that the Bible actually doesn't teach that people are going to heaven. Instead, it teaches that the hope of the human, the redeemed human, is actually on this earth. A renewed earth, to be sure, but nevertheless on the earth. So this idea that the earth is going to be destroyed is actually not taught in the Bible. Here's an example from an evangelical publisher noting the use of recycled paper. And here's a rather clever little poster. God recycles, he made you out of dust. And there's a quotation there from Genesis 2 and verse 7. So this is just pointing to what we are. We're made out of the earth. A Jewish environmental movement, what would Noah do? Noah preserving species. So again, a kind of an icon for the environment. This is probably overreading the account of Noah, which obviously has a very important religious message. But it's interesting to see the story of Noah being used for environmental causes. And this is not new. I mean, it'd be very simple. It'd be very easy to say, well, you know, these Jewish and Christian environmentalists are sort of Johnny-come-latelys. But actually, if you look in the traditions, there are deep roots to these ideas. So the Leviticus rabbis, so if you go back to the Talmudic tradition, here's a text that links up with what we're saying. How can a person of flesh and blood follow God? God, from the very beginning of creation, was occupied before all else with planting. We've looked at that verse, right? Genesis 2, verse 8. And as it is written, and first of all, the eternal God planted a garden in Eden. Therefore, occupy yourselves first and foremost with planting. Moses Maimonides, in order to serve God, one needs access to the enjoyment of the beauties of nature, such as the contemplation of flower-decorated meadows, majestic mountains, flowering rivers, for all these are essential to the spiritual development of even the holiest people. Now, there's a tradition that started up in Israel in the 1890s called Tu Bishvat, 15 Shivat, it's a date in the Jewish calendar, and it's the Jewish holiday known as the New Year of the Trees. It will next be observed on the 4th of February, 2015. So it's mentioned in the Mishnah, so this goes right back to the ancient world in Judaism. So it's the agricultural new year, and it's the day when the agricultural cycle began and ended. And the practice founded in the 1890s involves planting trees in the nation of Israel with the support of the Jewish National Fund. So here's something that comes from within the Jewish tradition, and it's planting trees, not cutting trees down. Another Jewish environmental movement takes its name from the word for ground in Hebrew, which we've already encountered, Adama. One thing we talked about this weekend is the revival of the Shemitah, and this is the year of release, or the land Sabbath, which is mentioned in the Old Testament, in the Law of Moses, for example, in Deuteronomy 15. And this is a release for the land, when the land lies fallow for a year, every seventh year, but also a time of economic release when debts are forgiven. And this is becoming extremely popular in Israel, and it comes from the Bible, a very positive environmental practice. Now, as we wind down, we want to also think a little bit about the Christian tradition and the origins of the study of ecology, because they do have some Christian roots. And so the first intimation in Western culture that nature is an interconnected system actually comes from the Genesis account of creation, where we see the structure of the Genesis account of creation, chapter 1, showing interconnectedness between the first and the second triads. Now, if we move forward to the time of Linnaeus in the 18th century, Linnaeus is basically the founder of modern biology, and he's the one who came up with the binomial nomenclature system. He had this notion of the economy of nature. By the economy of nature, we understand the all-wise disposition of the Creator in relation to natural things by which they are fitted to produce general ends and reciprocal uses. This word, economia, is actually found in the Bible. It's the word stewardship, which we mentioned this morning in the exhortation. So the economy of nature is something for him that is created by God. So we get our word economy from this Greek word, and it essentially means system, or at least in the way it's used. And so an economy, when we talk about the economy, we're talking about a financial system, but it was used in a religious sense, and it was also used for nature itself. And so we can see that the language comes from the Bible. Early biologists talked about the economy of nature, and they saw this as something created by God. Ernst Haeckel coins the word ecology, and it's meant as basically a synonym for economia. And you can see that it still has one of the roots, the word for house. So the word ecology has roots that go back into the Christian tradition. Now, I want to come back to what I was talking about earlier, and that is that there are some problems within the Christian tradition that surely need to be exposed. So back to Stephen Bowman-Prediger. A famous proponent of this perspective, that is to say, the idea that there will be a rapture and a destruction of the earth, is James Watt. Some of you may remember him, the first Reagan-era Secretary of the Interior. In response to a question during a discussion on February 5, 1981, with a committee of the House of Representatives as to why his agency was acting contrary to its expressed mandate, Watt, a devout Christian, said, "I do not know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns." This might not make any sense. But Bowman-Prediger goes on to explain. In other words, since Jesus is coming back soon, and since when Jesus returns, everything will be destroyed, why care about the earth? Yosemite or Yellowstone, Ile Royale or the Everglades, the park down the street, the local river or stream, your backyard. The popularity of books written by contemporary rapture advocating writers Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye attest to the allure of this eschatology. And so, we see recently in the movie Left Behind, starring Nicolas Cage. I haven't seen this movie. Apparently, it didn't get very good reviews. But nevertheless, a Hollywood version of this story about the rapture, that believers are going to be raptured off the earth, which the Bible does not teach. And ultimately, although it's not in this movie, I don't think the earth is destroyed. Now, some of this comes from a Platonic injection into Christianity. So Plato taught that we have a soul and that the material world is evil, that you want to escape that. We see something very similar in Gnosticism. The material world is evil. We want to escape the material world into a realm of pure spiritual existence. And we can see how these ideas infiltrated Christianity and helped bring about this idea that when you die, you go to heaven and that the earth is going to be destroyed. And so Calvin DeWitt, who is an evangelical environmentalist, talks about the effort to de-Platonize Christian theology, biblical theology, and ultimately traditional Christian theology. And so he talks about that here. I've already mentioned that with respect to this book, Let Creation Rejoice. So another response to Lynn White's book is by Ernest Feenstra. And what he says, essentially, in his response, is that Lynn White has missed a very important point about Genesis chapter 1, and that is that it's pointing to stewardship. And so he says, as steward of the universe, man is challenged to develop natural resources to benefit all creatures aesthetically and materially, and by so doing, to honor his creator and redeemer. Such Christian stewardship of natural resources does not include exploitation for selfish gain at the expense of society, nor pollution of land, air, or water. So an example of stewardship that's inspired in part by the biblical notion of stewardship is what I referred to earlier, the Eden Project, which was built in a disused China clay pit mine in Cornwall. And the founder of this project, or the mission director, I should say, makes the connection with the language of the Garden of Eden. The original Garden of Eden is a symbol of paradise, but also of mankind's rejection from it. Historically, conservation policies have also assumed that the best quality environments are touched by people, and that environmental care meant keeping people out of them. The real situation is more complex than that. Humans have caused lots of problems with the world, but there are also places where we have lived in harmony with nature without complete destruction, and sometimes with a beneficial effect. Many of the challenges that lie ahead can only be met by people being there, not by their walking away. So, as I said earlier, many environmentalists point to the serious problems in the environment. Yes, many of these have been caused by humans, but humans have the ability to correct them. Now, the more pessimistic view is that we've gone too far. And so the believer might then reflect on the fact that God has the power to intervene and correct the problems of the environment. Many of the challenges that lie ahead can only be met by people being there, not by walking away. Communities have already begun to take steps to be effective stewards of the world. The Eden Project is here to showcase those steps. So he's alluding to this notion of stewardship, but also, of course, to Eden. Here's another allusion to Eden. Dan Daggett, Gardeners of Eden, Rediscovering Our Importance to Nature, has shown that actually many ancient peoples were operating and farming in areas that we consider to be pristine wilderness. So, for example, the Amazon rainforest. Who knew? But we now know that there were large farms in the Amazon rainforest and that the natives there were managing the environment. So as we conclude, we need to refer to 2 Peter chapter 3, which is the chief text that many people point to as describing the destruction of the earth. Right? So in the King James Version, it says that the earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. And there's a description of the heavens dissolving, etc., etc. But in more modern translations, instead of it saying the earth will be burned up, it says all the works that are done on it will be exposed. So it turns out that that reading of the earth being burned up is a corrupt text, almost certainly, and that the original said that the earth will be exposed. If we look at this text closely, we can conclude that it doesn't talk about the earth being destroyed. And as a matter of fact, it's probably not talking about the physical earth at all. It's probably talking about political systems. But this is the only passage that really could be turned to as supporting the destruction of the earth, and it turns out that it's based on a faulty reading. Something else to reflect upon is this view that comes in Revelation 11, verse 18. Judgment on the destroyers of the earth. The nations were angry, but your anger has come. The time has come for the dead to be judged, to reward your servants, the prophets, your holy people, and those who fear your name, no matter if they are important or unimportant, and to destroy those who destroy the earth. So here we have a message from the Bible, and we won't get into the interpretation of it, but certainly at the literal level, it's condemning those who destroy the earth. So this is at variance with the common view that the Bible has a negative attitude about the environment. The Bible tells us that the world was created to be inhabited, by animals, life forms, and also by human beings. He didn't create it to destroy it. He created it for human habitation, ultimately for human habitation in the future after the return of Christ. Isaiah 45, 18, the Lord created the heavens. He formed the earth and made it. He set it up. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. This is what the Lord says. I am the Lord, and there is no other. And we have some wonderful passages in the Bible that speak about the restoration of the environment. This is the Carmana Valley, by the way. Another beautiful scene from a national park in the United States. And what we see in the Bible, at the end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, is not that humans leave the earth and that the earth is destroyed to go to heaven, but rather that heaven comes to earth and the righteous will reign with Christ on the earth. This is what it says in Revelation 5 and verse 10. Revelation 21, the beginning, verse 1 says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And then this wonderful vision of a kind of return to Eden that we see at the beginning of Revelation 22. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and from the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, for his servants will worship him. They will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. And night will be no more. They will have no need of light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. So how then shall the believer live, knowing these things from the Bible? Well, we should attempt to fulfill our divine mandate of benign stewardship, not putting ourselves first or taking more than we need, but acting as good stewards of the land and natural resources that God has given us, serving and preserving the garden, and also taking heed to the biblical pronouncements about social justice and loving our neighbor and making sure that we are not causing our neighbor or those in other parts of the world to suffer because of our greed and because of our accumulative materialism. And then we can look at these beautiful pictures of the restoration of Eden and live our lives with that as our goal.